Yeah, well, we got a lot to talk about. Some fun stuff on the horizon.
This is like, I mean, do you mean in terms of like specifically like the blockchain stuff and the things here?
Yeah, also just the next release. Feels like, the pace of change continues to
Would you say it's accelerating?
I would say the second derivative is going up. Yeah.
So we're into like a positive third derivative now.
Yeah, or at least, greater than equal to
That's
zero.
So right, I guess the third derivative isn't going up. Third derivative is just positive, which means the second derivative is going up, which means
I
we don't have much time left in the solar system.
yeah, I love that quote. Like, it's like a Nixon quote that he like references the second derivative of the GDP. Like a very specific way to describe, because he was describing like, yes, GDP is going down, but the rate of change is decreasing. It's going down more slowly than it was before.
Yeah, might wanna know your audience.
It's a beautiful thing to
Do you
say.
wanna just talk like start like, dropping alpha about the next release so people know sort of what to expect and then maybe how that'll fit into this more not really speculative stuff that we're talking about, but stuff that doesn't exist yet, because it's useful to know what does
Sure.
exist or is about to.
Sure. I'll go through the administrative work because this is basically a podcast and is being recorded. So this at by the end of this week, we're going to be putting out 0.6, or at least a release candidate. I mean, we still have some like actual feature changes, so I don't know if like we'll get the release out, but have a release candidate for 0.6, which includes some changes to the system. It's a breaking change release because it's like we're using the minor version as breaking for when we're pre 1.0. But basically, the big changes are that we've added this multi-chain RPC provider to the runtime. So built into every keynode is basically an API for reading in RPC data from blockchains that comport to like the EVM or Ethereum RPC standard. So that's a large percentage of chains and rollups that we intend to like have people build apps on. So you can get that data from RPC endpoints that are just a URL, or you can actually use the in-network RPC protocol, which means you're getting your RPC data from other nodes. So that's basically like a provider system that's built into the OS
That
now.
goes and that goes a long way towards setup ability and deployability. Like you can deploy a node and then not immediately have this extra step of, okay, now I have to sign up for something to get an RPC link or ask someone for it, which is that's a lot of friction. Like it inserts like minutes or tens of minutes of human time in which to the loop, which is awful.
And of course, it's really configurable. So like basically, the end game for a system such as Keynote is always to have like a light node or a full node running alongside your OS. So that's possible. But then like if you don't want to do that for whatever reason, there's a lot of good reasons, you can get somebody else to do that in the network, right? So I can be running an Ethereum full node and a Keynote, and I can provide RPC over the Keynote network just because I'm getting it sort of straight from the source, right? So that's sort of like the vision. And it's multi-chain, right? So like I might be running an Ethereum layer one node, but somebody else could be running like an Optimism validator, right? Or any rollup validator, and they can act as an RPC provider over the network. And using this in apps like programmatically is super simple because you're just changing the chain ID. The API stays the same. And so we've got several apps that are already like using that new API. And that's the breaking change, by the way, is the API for using the RPC provider. It's a really nice API now, though. I'm happy with it. So I think that'll be frozen for quite a while anyway. The other administrative stuff is we've made improvements to the App Store, so it's easier to publish apps. The stuff that you post on chain is a little easier to post. The data is, the data structure has changed to include more relevant information and less irrelevant information. Then we've got improvements to the runtime that enable like better hosting. So stuff with like the password and encryption on like the sort of node creation side have been simplified, made secure, gotten ready for hosting. We have a person working on hosting as a service, essentially, which has really guided that.
We should talk about like what that does, or how even like maybe talk about the Holium thing and how that, you know, uses that off the bat, but the other things we have also for that.
Yeah, I mean, so that basically wraps up the administrative stuff. We've got a bunch of bug fixes, various security things, and then we did like a front end, like sexy redesign. So that'll be visible in 0.6. But yeah, that's all the administrative stuff. Let's talk about Holium.
Yeah, so basically, I guess they like released their stuff talking about what they were building on us. And I think, you know, maybe even more interesting than the specific thing that they're building, which is pretty cool, they're, you know, meme deck software to allow like, you know, having this like networked app between users that also integrates with Twitter in browser extension to share memes. Just that it was like, I think, easy for them to do a couple things that are normally annoying, which is one, just all the back and forth between the users and getting that all like wired up, having like hosting just work so that they can onboard people very easily. And then I think just the sort of outside world integrations, like they were able to get stuff working in terms of being able to hook out to outside models and have them run fast enough, be able to integrate with Twitter and OAuth in the way they wanted. And just like, I think the main thing is not maybe even the specific thing they built, but at all stages when the question is, okay, can I build this, or is it, you know, reasonably easy to do? The answer has been yes, sometimes pending like a couple primitives that we needed to put in. But I think really expanding our vision of like, okay, you can kind of do anything that you want, and we want to, you know, further keep extending that set, which will probably go into what we're talking about today. Yeah, what else would you say there, Doria?
Well, props to Holium for using the beta version of this software. And it's been great working with them, because it helps when somebody's trying to build something ambitious and you get to get that feedback immediately while you're still in beta and while you still can make big changes. So that's been great. It's also been great seeing where we can make big changes. And we feel more confident that we're like ready for that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some other bigger, like, you know, things we've held off on in terms of releasing to developers or other projects or pushing them. And I think they're getting us incrementally more confident in doing that. And it didn't take forever. It was like, you know, a month or so to start feeling better and better. And so I think you can kind of extrapolate that out because of the acceleration to probably post 0.6, being able to onboard other projects, which I think will start to go a long way towards asking, what can you use this for? How is it different from other peer-to-peer systems like AOS, stuff like that? And the answer is going to lie in all these integrations you can do, and how the answer to, can I do that in your system, or is it over too opinionated to let me do that, is going to be, yes, you can. But I think you need to sort of show that. So I think the exciting thing about their first release will be the first really concrete thing of like, okay, this is an app that a company's trying to like build with, raise money for, get rich with, that uses this stuff like fully and exercises a lot of its different parts, like in some cases hitting resources that aren't on every node and are done by a provider, or even integrating with outside centralized services like Twitter or a small centralized service they run. Because look, one maybe prior criticism of some of the stuff that Holium had to do or wanted to do was that it did have these centralized components. And I think it's just really good if you can be honest about that, locate them in a specific part of the system, and then interface with them properly in a way that lets you like extend. And so I think we've let them do a lot of really, you know, really natural stuff with that, where the things that are correctly decentralized or per user are done that way. And then the things that really should be centralized because you're trying to provide user convenience and it doesn't give lock-in, you should let those be cleanly centralized. And so I think we've just been, it's been cool to kind of exercise every part of those design patterns and be really forced to like, find ways to tell them yes rather than no, that's out of scope, which is just a bullshit cop out. But most of these, you know, if you look at most of these other systems, they will at the like sort of bottom out undoing that. If you look at what you can do again in something like, you know, Arweave OS or Pairs or something like that.
Yeah.
Gonna reference real like production P2P systems that work and have ambitions, rather than sort of, you know, more hypothetical, you know, ones that have taken longer to get to production.
Yes, Bazil. It's very true. I concur. Well, should we move on to the sort of main topic of the space today and talk about the roll-up centric future that we're sort of thinking about?
Yeah, and that has like a few components. So I think in order to do that, let's just give people who don't know the quick idea of what validiums are and why you would care about them and how they contrast with data availability. I can let you do that, or I can.
Let's bring on Finger as a speaker too, by the way.
Oh yeah, let him in.
He's been invited. Goldfinger, if you want to speak, you can just accept the invitation.
I'll give the quick like background real quick on what it is, because we're going to use the words a lot. So basically, whenever you're running any kind of roll up, you need to decide, that's producing transactions which all contain data, and you have to make sure in some way that everyone who cares gets a shot at seeing that data. Otherwise, it's meaningless to use some kind of consensus roll-up sequencing system, because all you know is, okay, I know what the state of this chain is, but I don't know what the pieces of that are, and so they can't be spent. And for, again, sort of deep cuts, but for anyone who, like me, was like around when Plasma was being developed, and in that, that's what it ultimately sort of foundered on, was realizing that you actually really do need some way to ensure data availability, and there's no like tricks you can do to get around it. Data availability just means everyone gets a shot at seeing the data that constitutes transactions, and you have some way of guaranteeing that. So the two main approaches here, you can kind of split hairs, they mostly fall into this, are put the data through on chain through the normal consensus system, where all validators in that chain, in this case Ethereum L1, come to consensus that everyone has gotten a shot at seeing this. And there's sort of more advanced protocols like donk sharding that do that in a more efficient way and let you blast through a lot of data. There's things like EIP 4844 that make that cheaper by saying, okay, we don't have to store that data long term, just for like a month or so, once we guarantee everyone see it. But it all reduces to your transaction data gets blasted through on chain in a way that like all the consensus validators guarantee that, are kind of attesting to the fact that everyone's seen it. The other model, which so that's great. That's really important for super high value data, or even, anything in the even hundreds or thousands of dollars. But there's a lot of cases where you're like, okay, I'm running a game and I need to trade game assets or update game state. And I would like to get some kind of consensus on that. Because it's a little bit more valuable to the game and needs a little bit more than just like a centralized server running it. But I need higher throughput, and I don't really need to pay for the consensus validators to guarantee they've seen the data, because this data is a little bit more ephemeral. It's measured in the cents or dollars or tens of dollars in terms of what it's worth to people. And so for that case, the structure you immediately kind of hit on is something like a validium, which a validium is just you have a data layer, and the guarantee that everyone's seen it is not provided by a ton of consensus. It's provided by what essentially is a multi-sig. And the multi-sig has X number of people and M number of people, and N of them at a given time say, we've seen the data, and you can sign off on that on-chain to advance the state of the roll-up. So it's a very, very attractive architecture for things like games, social apps, things that might need some kind of consensus around actions that get taken, because you can imagine a social app that, like, pays for follows or makes you pay for retweets or what have you. You have some kind of minor payment or asset change and measured again in cents or dollars, but you don't want it. It's not worth it economically to pay for on-chain data, even in cheap forms like, with EIP 4844. And so a validium is just how you do that. Now, that then immediately brings up a lot of logistical questions, which are like, okay, how do you let people become part of this multi-sig? How do you let them run the software that passes that data through? How do you write the indexing software that lets apps reference the data that they're blasting through? All this kind of stuff that is very easy to verbalize, but becomes a big thing in production. But anyway, that's like just to give a high level of the discussion, because as we talk about ZK, endgame, validiums, it's important to know that you mostly reduce to these two choices, which are, blast everything through all the consensus validators of a major chain like Ethereum, or Ethereum is pretty much the only one really doing that right now, because it's Celestia isn't integrated with a settlement layer, so I don't put it in the same category, or blast the data through a much smaller set of data validators who run like a multi-sig, and then the settlement for the roll-up on Ethereum is basically checking whether that multi-sig signed off. So first of all, any like questions about that? Because we're going to like refer to Validium's versus sort of on-chain data a lot, probably. If anyone wants to like raise their hand or put something in chat or clarify Doria or Goldfinger.
It's a good explanation. This is a lesson.
Well, there's a lot of this stuff that's kind of gone back and forth over the years, and people who weren't around for Plasma don't know how much evolution of thought and how much condensation and design has gone into this. But I think at this point in time, we know enough collectively about blockchain design that, you know, you really should put stuff into those categories like Validium's or on-chain data availability. And in both cases, the goal you're trying to achieve is make sure everyone who matters sees the data, and two, link that to settlement. It's really critical that if people have signed off on seeing the data, that then you can like deposit assets into the roll-up or withdraw them. Otherwise, they're sort of not real. And that's like the whole structure. So yeah. That change, yeah.
Yeah. No, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, I was going to say we should talk about next and maybe bring Goldfinger on, like how he thinks kind of commoditized ZK changes roll-ups. So first explain sort of what commoditized or easy to write ZK is, Goldfinger, and then, you know, how you think that changes the game from the perspective of companies and projects that want people who want to build roll-ups or use these kind of constructions.
Yeah, so I guess commoditized ZK just looks like, you know, mass adoption. It's like you're not writing Solidity anymore. You're not like learning some bespoke language. You're just writing like Rust or JavaScript or Python. And like with a minimal amount of auditing to make sure that like that system that you wrote is like deterministic and, you know, safe, then you can just deploy that and it can secure or like hold economic assets and handle bridging and all that. And so we're like shockingly close to this, at least in the case of Rust with SP1, where you're just writing normal Rust and it just proves it extremely, extremely quickly. So
and writing normal Rust in this case means you're writing a normal Rust program and it's now responsible for controlling the assets in and out of the rollup or processing transactions. Just a much easier thing to think about and write than Solidity because it's a more normal language, it has more safety guarantees, and importantly, there's no gas gulping. You don't have to optimize your kind of compute cycles very much at all, really, for, you know, on-chain expense.
Well, let's talk about that because there
You have to optimize them somewhat. There are limits, but I mean relative to
I think that's mm-hmm. the interesting aspect of the commoditization. Well, it's another interesting aspect because when like to me what like commoditized ZK means is that you have an endless supply of options for execution environment, right? So some of them could be mm-hmm. like bespoke languages, right? And so what it comes down to for you, for the developer, is like, oh, let me find the best tool for the job. And depending on what kind of stuff that you want to do on your rollup, that could be a different programming language, right? So,
Absolutely. So
then also you get into this question of like, oh, well, like, what's great about commoditization is that like, oh, I could write like a proof of concept version of this thing in a language that I'm already familiar with. It's very low overhead. And then, oh, if I want to scale this or optimize it, I could switch to a completely different proving system, you know, because, you know, you mentioned SP1, there's a bunch of other people that are proving Rust as well, whether it's through RISC-V or through WASM. And so you might not even have to change the code to switch proving systems for optimizing. So like, that's the really like the field of play here is very, very wide.
Design space. Let's approach then the idea of end game kind of just by from different angles, which another angle of it is that once you have these proving systems, as long as you have kind of a shared layer on the layer one or layer two that can interpret the different proving systems and kind of agrees that they're sound, you can now have your rollups more easily share liquidity and get assets to each other, you know, async within one cycle of confirmation on that base layer. And so that means in turn that you don't have to choose the language you write your rollup in based on compatibility or liquidity. You just have to choose your sort of proving system or network that you're going into, whether it's a custom standard. I need to look more at the shared sequencing stuff on Ethereum because I think it's meant to directly address this. But essentially, there's a lot of stuff emerging around, you know, we're able to have rollups that can essentially trust each other because they know what each other's state transition functions are, and that those are, and you know, that those are proven.
Yeah, this is one thing I find like very inspiring about AO, is that basically what they have is like every single AO, you know, operating system instance is like a node or like a basically like a rollup, and then every message to another AO node is getting posted to Arweave for like data availability so that everyone can see it, and then it'll get like, you know, quote unquote sequenced by the other AOS that you pass the message to. And so actually, like, you know, we've engineered like a very, very similar system where it's like, you know, you're going to have your key node, which is like basically running a sequencer. And then what we need to build now is basically a way to get the messages, which would normally just be like a normal, you know, message from one node to the other or one sequencer to the other, posting that to like some kind of data availability layer. So then basically what you have is are like secure cross rollup messages that are like just very, very quick and allow you to like transfer assets.
And this actually lets us start to talk about the choices we make versus Arweave OS. Which is that the question that I know Doria will bring up in any of these systems is, you know, once we have this working, they have it working, there is a limit to how much computation you can put on chain, even in these ZK constructions. It's right now, you know, it takes about, say, a million times or so, maybe longer, to prove than it does to run the code, which is very acceptable for lower bandwidth, even a decent amount of bandwidth. That's the difference between, you know, nanoseconds and milliseconds, which is, you know, milliseconds are fine in a lot of cases, or even seconds. And then even the theoretical bound is probably something like 1,000 times slower, and we're quite far from the theoretical bound. Like, you know, a million or, you know, 10 million and 1,000 are very, very different numbers. And so what that means is there's a ton of computation in any scenario that needs to be done off-chain. And I think where we're really trying to excel is not just in really nailing this roll-up construction, but then being able to nail, as we were saying with Holium, kind of being able to integrate it with arbitrary like applications. And I think that that's a sort of understated part of the eventual end game, is making sure that you have a really good application integration story for your backends and how they connect to, you know, outside AI models, APIs, the data internal to like the node, the data that other nodes have that are running more as like centralized or quasi-centralized services, like stuff like that.
Yeah, what I think is interesting is that like we didn't actually design, you know, Keynote to be good for sequencing, but it just kind of so happens that it really is. You know, I remember back when we were working on Urbit, there was like this, I think like it was like TED, he said in some interviews, like, you know, Urbit is kind of like a personal blockchain. And like looking back at that quote, it's like, actually, like if you take that to the logical conclusion, then like you get AOS or like what we've built or like what we're currently building, which is actually like a really fucking good idea. And like we should have, it kind of is weird that we didn't hit upon that earlier, because it is kind of like just the obvious killer app.
I think we were aware of it and wanted, and we're always building to that. We were just technically blocked. And I think we're also very, I think we were also very aware of the need to eventually put it with applications, because I've always been pretty aware of the, you know, just orders of magnitude between proving time and running time, and how people just are inevitably going to want to do things that have lots more compute. You can't compute bound like that, especially in an age of AI when people are, we're actually very compute limited.
Yeah, I want to just hang on with the thing of like the personal blockchain, because I don't agree that that's the right construction for everything. And so that's actually where I would like, you know, criticize like the AO construction, is because if you're saying you're going to run everything you do through a personal blockchain, you're like right off the bat slicing out a whole category of use cases that don't want to use that kind of construction that are potentially very valuable. So I like what we have, in that it's not, and to the degree that it's not a personal blockchain, that it lets you do other things. And on the note of like the order of magnitudes thing, like I think this is a very like sort of interesting sort of philosophical debate. But, you know, something that's really interesting about computing today is that, you know, obviously computers are ridiculously, ridiculously fast. And every so often somebody will make a really good point that like the loading screens on like, you know, NT or OS 9 were like, they're better than they are now. Like our computers are slower in some ways than they were back when it was like a much more raw system. And I think that partially because of one of the evils of software development, where people that are not building the final product, the sort of topmost layer of the stack that users actually interact with, they get lazy and they say, oh, well, what's an order of magnitude here or an order of magnitude there? And if you're a developer and you're building software for other developers, you're saying, hey, use my software, you don't get to be, you know, happy-go-lucky with the orders of magnitude that you're slicing out of your system, because that privilege is reserved for the final developer on the stack. They get to be the one.
Fix your attitude to software development and fix your attitude to life, said Linus.
Yeah. Well, no, like genuinely, like the last developer to use the framework before it becomes an actual app, they should be the one that gets to say, oh, whatever. Yeah, make that O of N, make that O of N squared. I don't care because it's fast enough for my users. If you're building software for other developers, what you do when you do that and you say, oh, it's only a million times slower. Like you said, like, and you're right, like, oh, you know, nanoseconds to milliseconds, who really cares? That's true if you are the person that's writing the app that the user's gonna touch, because the user won't notice milliseconds.
And notably, the market is ruthless. The market is ruthless here. Like, if you build something and it can't handle those cases, the market will just like select away from you for all the people who need it, which is why, like, you know, low-level languages are still heavily used in games or very specific frameworks. Right. It's why, you know, AI like really does still depend on CUDA. And even like, you know, other languages, like other, you know, Metal is having to like, you know, write, get its libraries, like, you know, really good. And that makes a huge difference for ML, like inference and training, especially even inference is often like compute bound like that. And so if you don't do that, what will happen is the market will just like lop off 90% of your TAM right off the bat. And then probably something else will happen and it'll lop off another 80% of your TAM. And before you know it, your only TAM is chat apps.
So we're trying not to do that. We're trying.
Yeah.
We're trying
and actually, by the way, to be specific, I actually think that AOS is, I've been pretty generous to them. So I think they have a cool, well thought out construction. But if someone wanted like a criticism of that, of them, it would be that they're lopping off lots of their TAM by committing to certain constructions. And that doesn't mean that the thing isn't useful or won't get use, although we'll see. But it like right off the bat, you're only usable in that like sort of maybe personal kind of blockchain case. And if someone else nails that case while providing access to drop into other performance and connect to it cleanly, they're going to eat your lunch. This is actually like actually sort of a similar I had in the notes of this talk to talk about how L2s are very clearly like starting to win. And I'm, again, that's like a market-based thing where I'm seeing more and more from very like degen projects. The things that it allows them to do are very appealing, which is you can bridge ETH whales with no like, you know, with very minimal bridging assumptions. That they're like, they can be a lot more comfortable with, that might have multi-sig assumptions, but don't have other like timing ones or other attacks, which is like a really big deal because every other bridge has basically gotten like ruthlessly exploited that has assumptions beyond, let's say, multi-sig. And then also like, you know, you can deploy stuff in Solidity, which is good. I think once they see that you can just easily roll out infrastructure with those minimal bridging assumptions that uses other languages, that will be great. But like there's all these other projects have like added these other assumptions to what you have to do. And like L2s are just like, you know what? You can go basically as fast as your computer can blast it through, or as fast as like the data availability can be economically feasible. And you can like bridge to Ethereum with maximum assumptions of like multi-sig, either on your computation or on your data availability. And that is very attractive. And like, you don't have to like it or not. That's why, you know, there's this sort of hated rally for ETH, I think, where it's just like it just keeps relentlessly chugging along no matter what, like, you know, Chris Bernisky says, because like it just has the right, like the right properties.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the jury is still out in terms of other things like user experience, but you know, that's sort of like, I would say that
I would say it's not that out, really, because like once you're talking about just, once you treat an L2 as just a bridging operation, and it's like, I have my assets on ETH, do I want to bridge them to Solana or to an L2? The L2 has easier bridging assumptions. And once, I mean, download Rabi, and now your like, you know, wallet experience is better than anything on like, let's say like Solana. And, you know, you're all, and so I think there's a lot that can be improved in these things and should be, but it's already sort of, you know, Pareto optimal in my opinion. And notably, I think projects are showing that in the market, but that's, you're right. That is a sort of another story.
I definitely agree with that point. I think if you look at exciting projects, I think that L2s are gathering up a really great amount of those. And that points us to like why we're focusing on this roll-up case is because if you skate where the puck is going on this trend, you do arrive at the Validium or app, quote unquote, app chain construction. That's sort of like, you know, a vaguely misleading term because it doesn't necessarily mean one Validium per app, but it does look like the conclusion being you have L2s that are these economic zones. They inherit, they roll up to ETH, but then within those you have really like, yeah, hyperscaled Validium constructions that are running and posting data there or posting it directly to ETH even, depending on price. And so we want to get in on that, and we want to be a place where developers can deploy those and program around them with the, like, in a maximally easy way.
And so far, like the one sort of piece missing from this story, like if you sort of imagine, like, basically, you know, already today it's like trivial to launch your own rollup for like, I think like $3,000 a month or maybe less. It's like EVM, and you can get all like the shitcoin info that you want for free, basically, and like it'll just work. Like the one sort of thing like missing from this whole future is like cross rollup liquidity or like bridging, basically, because like liquidity fragmentation is like very quickly just going to become a huge issue in this ecosystem. And so like if you build like a good system where basically, you know, you can use whatever, you know, language you want to like build your app chain, and then it's super easy to move liquidity around within that ecosystem, then it's like it's a pretty big deal.
Yep. And this is also where I think the ETH construction like out competes for L2s, because there's definitely a lot of liquidity fragmentation right now, but there's a path to getting out of that hole, and it's much faster than the path for other things. And so I think it's like, you know, it's sort of one motivated person away, plus some, you know, network effects and adoption from filling in, which is, you know, a good place to be technically. Let's talk about, I mean, like what the, what, so let's kind of summarize that, Doria or Goldfinger, like, what do you think the end game looks like for this? Cause for me, I guess I would start with, there's a lot of rollups. You can deploy them easily whenever you want or use an existing one, for the purposes of your app. Meaning you can use existing infrastructure from other people and hook into it, or if you have, you know, even at very pretty low levels of economic sustainability, you can run your own for your application. But then notably, it can link back into base Ethereum relatively, you know, sanely, and also have cross rollup liquidity between more of your own rollups that you deploy and other people's. And also, critically, one thing we haven't talked about is it will be easily programmable to read and write events from it, because it's really important in this construction that the rest of your app, and there will almost always be a rest of your app, can play nicely with this stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's where we come in. That's what the title of the space is about.
And we can talk about, we actually come in multiple parts of that thing I just verbalized, which is, I think we come in more than people understand for the, you need to roll out this roll up either for yourself or use someone else's, also for the indexing part, storage part, all of that, and then the app part. But I think the first one is actually maybe a little bit more interesting and unexpected, because we've talked about the other one so many times.
Yeah, no, that is true. So that's another big part is like, and this is, okay, so like I wrote down before the space, like I think there's a subtle distinction between like roll-up infrastructure as it gets currently discussed in this industry and what we're going for here, which is more of like roll-up deployment and usability at the developer level. Like roll-up infrastructure conjures like hardware, AWS type instances. You're talking about like cloud, bare metal. You're talking about something where, like, you're paying somebody a monthly fee to run a compute service for you and do certain.
You're inevitably, and like, I don't want to dash anyone's bubbles, but you are inevitably running a complex series of CLI scripts if you're bad, or, you know, Terraform or something like that if you're good.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't enjoy if you know how to do that easily. There are some very well paying jobs waiting for you. Like, I enjoy that world, but it is not a readily. The economics of it are rough for even for experienced developers.
Yeah, but it's not a bad thing, right? That's sort of like a fact of the universe. Obviously, if you're doing stuff with compute, there's going to be computers involved.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying that the economics suck, and it's inevitably a schlep for people, except for the you know, 10,000 people in the world who are very good at it and do it all the time and are well paid to do so. Like, on our team, we have like Jonathan, and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, you had me like maybe 5 years ago, and then I stopped it. And so I would need to like boot up, but it is a, you know, it is a real skill. It takes time to maintain and to keep like fluency in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a whole industry. But so then like, yeah. So to show the other thing is like, if you get away from that, when you're doing a node-based computing environment, which is like what we've built, right, where everything is sandboxed, contained in Wasm, you have this nice, you know, layer between you and the hardware. It's very abstracted. It's very opinionated. You can build something like a rollup and just deploy it, right, on your personal server, and that becomes the target. And that is like a much more attractive thing for like your average developer that's building an app. Is like, it's just a much more approachable thing. And like, you know, you've said earlier, like there's always going to be a rest of the app when it comes to these rollup constructions. And so being able to build the rollup right next to that rest of the app is really nice. And that includes like front end too, by the way, like literally like to the UI level of what you're presenting to a user's web browser, to their phone, like the programming environment. The closer the programming environment for that piece is to the programming environment where the rollup is running and the financial transactions are being processed, like, that's a tighter and tighter feedback loop. And on the at the developer experience level, I think that's where we're sort of like have this very big comparative advantage and what we have to offer. So yeah, that's how I would sum it up, actually, is the difference between like, yeah, talking about something like Terraform or like basically a DevOps tooling component slash hardware provider service, and then this like unified programming environment.
But let's not even the DevOps tooling one is still pretty complicated in those once you have to start linking everything together. So I actually want to maybe bring in Goldfinger to kind of maybe take a step back and walk us through the typical, let's call it DGen project, that wants to roll out like, you know, its own rollup and what its choices currently are today and how that feels. Do you want to speak about that a little? Or if you need me to role play, I can, but I think you can probably put us in the shoes of one of those projects because I think it is illuminating.
Yeah, yeah. Do you mean like which service providers you can go through already or like all the steps that are going through?
Yeah, I think from the perspective of someone like, you know, your guy who we talked to the other day, and kind of like you're a project, you think you have something interesting, you want to integrate a roll-up aspect with it that's your own. To whom are you talking? What are you thinking about having your devs do? What are the steps between where you are now of having an idea and verbalizing it to having that in production?
Yeah, so I mean, basically it's like, I should mention that there are all these like service providers. So like, if you want an EVM, you can basically do that today, right? And it's
Let's talk about what that looks like. Okay, so you want the EVM. What does the service provider do for you? Let's like go through and what you get and what you don't get.
Yeah, basically you pay them the price of like a junior software dev, and what you get is like a sequencer based like an RPC endpoint that is yours. Mm-hmm. And then they handle everything else. Which includes like data availability and like, you know,
So they're doing let's be kind of concrete. They're like running the like, you know, servers for you that process like the data. They're indexing it when your RPCs call it, right? For apps on it. They're probably deploying or using contracts deployed on L1 or L2 on ETH to like process it. They're like giving you an interface to set up your I guess probably their own multisig for data availability for the Millennium thing, like doing all of that, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And what does that get you? What can you then do with that?
Basically, I mean, depending on what security model you chose, you can just like start blasting through a ton of transactions. Mm-hmm.
And notably, these transactions will be Solidity contracts that you're like deploying, right?
Right. I'm not aware of anyone that's doing this for like Risk Zero or anything like that yet.
Mm-hmm. But they could.
Yeah, I mean, like as that stuff matures, like yeah, it'll happen.
So an interesting thing, like right off the bat, is like, okay, how do you provide that for, you know, let's say Rust type stuff, general proving? And the other thing is, I think it's people can kind of sleep on economics, but you know, price of a junior software dev is fine if your project is proven out. But if you are trying to get product market fit or you're a small team, that's like a very high barrier. Like if you're a random, because like this should be the case where you can be a random dev, work in your spare time and deploy something like this. And having to, you know, first contract someone for that amount of money is a non-starter because you might be a junior software dev yourself. And so, you know, post-taxes and food, you're significantly in the hole in that setup.
Right, right. And so like a kind of more ideal like app chain setup would be kind of like, you know, you build your app and it's like, okay, we're in like beta mode, right? And it's like, mm-hmm. it's basically proof of authority. It's like, I'm the only data availability committee member, right? And so like, mm-hmm. you're implicitly trusting me, put however much money you are comfortable with that. And then over time, like as it accrues more value, you start expanding the data availability committee such that like it's more and more decentralized and the multisig is bigger. And that, like, the likelihood that, like, having, your funds will get trapped.
Having that passed is very valuable. And the stuff we're talking about is stuff that, like, probably should be standardized and should be doable at a price of, like, depending on your scale, of, like, $20 to $500 a month. Like, something right. like that. It's probably, as opposed to, like, you know, we're talking about a junior software dev post-tax and everything. You're talking in, like, the $10,000 a month range. Like, we're talking about... you know, multiple orders of magnitude, which make a difference. And there's a lot of startups in software deployment based around getting, you know, 1 to 3 orders of magnitude in cost and ease down.
Right. And like,
you don't have to talk to the biz dev team for that roll up is also like pretty nice for that roll up provider.
Right. And like if you're just like a solo software engineer, right, just like trying to like find product market fit and make something cool. And it's like, it immediately, like you build this thing and it's like, you know, $10 to $100 a month to like host. And then it's like, oh, like people are telling me that like they want to put even more money on this. That like mm-hmm. they're so ready. Like we found product market fit. Then it's like, okay, you immediately have a path to scaling that.
You click some buttons.
Right.
And exactly. I think that because of just the economics of deploying software and how you do it, I am not ready to like go all in on this yet. But I think with the combination of people wanting non-EVM stuff being deployed and also the, you know, the idea of like every application in the world being able to run its own roll-up for different things, it's very, very attractive to, you know, try to be at the center of that. And that's something that Keynote is positioned to do. And I hadn't really verbalized it like that before, but in the ZK roll-up endgame where all apps, even trad apps, you know, are running roll-ups because it's useful to do that for tracking assets and payments and metering and even like, you know, micro payments, like all that kind of stuff you can suddenly do. It's very, very interesting to be, you know, the, not even cloud provider, it's like the kind of integrated SaaS service for that, that like knocks, that's, but like sort of a commoditized or decent, sort of easily deployable by anyone like SaaS service.
Yeah, I completely agree.
That's like, we should actually write that one up pretty soon into a blog post, because this is a huge addressable market that really does depend on a lot of these pieces fitting together. And it actually is probably doable with our current primitives plus some work on just commoditizing the contracts that get deployed in Solidity. So you never have to touch Solidity. And then from there, just like all the libraries to work with, like, you know, indexing, data availability committees, stuff like that.
Right. I would also note that like the existing roll-up providers that like do the sort of like EVM stuff, like, you know, to actually like do what we're about to do, you do get to a point where you're like reinventing Keynote or like having to build your own OS. And like, yeah. I know this is the case because I like thought we didn't have to do this like literally a week ago, or that I wasn't about to reinvent Keynote, and then I did. So, you know.
Yeah, I think I saw it. And then I think Will.Keynote like was the one who told you like you're just gonna like reinvent Keynote if you do this.
Yeah, I think I didn't listen, and then I discovered it by myself. So
yeah, which is look, you're representative of the median, not by IQ, but by like sort of, I guess, like market perception or being head down on their own work. Developers are uniquely, this has been true for like multiple decades, probably since the 1950s. Developers are like uniquely bad at estimating how far the difference between a Turing complete verbalization and implementation will be. And Turing completeness is almost like a curse in a lot of ways, because like every developer either explicitly or implicitly knows it, that if you can sort of get to a certain level of functionality, you can build anything. And then it's a very short step from that to thinking, I've verbalized this, so it's probably not that bad. And there's a lot of projects, a lot of the most successful sort of projects and companies in the world exist in that space between when the developer like says that and when they actually have to get something to market. And so I think in this case, there is multiple orders of magnitude of juice between verbalizing that you want a roll-up for your app and cost effectively getting it to market ergonomically really fast. And you know, Doria, we haven't even talked about the, you know, app integrated parts yet. This is just like that thing in the roll-up end game. And in the roll-up end game, this stuff has to be able to be done at that, like, probably anyone should be able to do it for, you know, a few dollars a month eventually, and then scale it up to like, you know, probably a maximum of like $1,000 a month, depending on scale.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting stuff.
Let me think if there's a lot to do here. Even if we have Edgar on the call, we should just make a note to like start writing about this, like, you know, SaaS type thing and looking at how we could make something that makes it doable while having a product that targets it. But I think
Edgar is on the call, and Edgar is making Edgar. Notes.
Do you get what we're talking about? Is this like, is this accessible?
I'm always 10 steps ahead of you.
It's not enough. We need multiple orders of magnitude of steps. 10 is you're
competed rapidly. The second derivative of the steps I'm taking faster than you
is positive and possibly even increasing. Well, I guess like Doria, do you have anything to add to that? Because I know I kind of like went, maybe not against you, but like kind of double clicked on just the roll up ZK part of it and went pretty deep into what we can do there, because I was trying to make a pretty strong case for that. But is there sort of another part of that you want to focus on?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, if we're talking about roll ups, this covers it. I think, you know, this conversation is about roll ups, but the only thing I would add is that there's a bunch of other constructions too that developers want and use. And so, like, you know,
Maybe talk about some of those and how in the end game they might interact with roll ups, because I agree that that is a very bandwidth limited, even at high bandwidth construction.
Sure, right. Well, hey, I mean, even disregarding the bandwidth conversation, let's just talk about data provenance, right? Something that you and I have talked about is like different business use cases, right? When we're pitching people to build on Keynote, when we're talking to people who are interested, how is my business model going to look, right? There are business models in the world that don't benefit from sharing the data with users, right? There are like, you know, it pains me to say, but there are businesses where the competitive edge and the moat for them.
Yeah, if they shared their data, the business would never exist, because it would never be able to like sort of get funded except like philanthropically, and usually like that will then get out competed by someone who's able to raise the money and the enthusiasm non-philanthropically. That is like, just this is just true.
This is just true. And so if you're gonna pitch to them, if you're gonna say, hey, here's a better way to build your system, you want to build a new program, here's how to do it, like, you can't offer them a roll-up, because they're not interested. That's not what they want to build. That's not the kind of, they don't want to build a protocol. They want to build a service. You know, I think that's a pithy way of putting it, right? They want to build a service, and that service probably could be centralized. It's probably doesn't need to be like hyper-scaled, right? Computers are fast. You can run a business on a really cheap VPS.
Well, if your business scales, you can. You're always going to, you know, despite the protestations of people on Twitter, I do understand the CAP theorem. And you are going to, unfortunately, you know, I'm not retarded from years of amphetamine abuse, so that also helps. But like, I think, you know, the CAP theorem does mean in these cases that you are generally going to have to make the choice to partition your data set at some point at a certain amount of scale. And this is a discussion we haven't really had much. Obviously, kind of naive implementation in these systems is that you partition on a per user basis, which I think is what this particular moron was getting at. And I think that's not always the way that you want to partition, or even if you're partitioning per user, it can be much more cost effective and programmatically ergonomic to partition based on like, you know, a hash of the user's ID and put like a lot of them in one place and have something for co-locating. Right. So we haven't even taught, I've thought about this a lot, but I think I might be the only one on our team to have done so, but I'm interested on your, you know, initial thoughts for how you can provide these services.
We've talked about it a little bit at the business level. And the point I'm trying to make here about the roll-ups is that what does a world look like where protocols that live on roll-ups and services that live sort of in a more traditional Web 2-y way can coexist? Like what, like right now the world does not look like that and these things cannot coexist. And so what kind of software would you have to write to make it so that they could coexist? And I think that's
kind of easy to roll out node software, but where you could also, you know, maybe easily select the performance that nodes have access to so that you can make, even if it's like, if you're buying it from another provider, that's great. But you might even want the ability to roll out your nodes on Hetzner or DigitalOcean and say like something like, at least I know this like, you know, Keynode is getting access to this much like, you know, CPU and hard drive. Because if it's your company doing that, you can do a lot of things, or if it's a trusted reseller, which I think is going to be more and more common.
Or even at the limit case, you're talking about a service which is running somewhere in the world on dedicated hardware and very optimized, and it has endpoints that people want to hit. And what does it look like for a user to be able to hit those endpoints and integrate them with protocols that they're running on rollups?
Yeah, right? Definitely.
Taking outside data resource, taking an outside service and saying, I trust this, I value this. Like, consider it like a centralized Oracle, right? And say, like, how do I make this, even though it's a totally centralized service, it's not programmable, I am paying them for value of some kind in a very traditional way. How do I integrate that with a decentralized compute?
I'm really attracted to the idea of doing some of the auth and endpoints and exposing of those oracles via inside Keynode, because I think it's very rare that those endpoints are bandwidth limited. There's some cases where they are, but it's very often the case that like you could productively connect your thing to it over it and have all the speed happening just sort of in like as a black box inside that. Sorry, we're talking about, we should give people context because people like context and concreteness. When we're talking about centralized oracles and data oracles, we're talking about the idea of what if, Airbnb decided that it had this like huge moat around its like network effects, reviews, stuff building up like that, and it wanted to expose parts of what it did as an oracle that other apps could use. And this is not at all theoretical. Like I was talking to a friend who's trying to actually currently sell a company that does B2B services for hotels that want to list tons of their rooms on Airbnb, which is a shockingly common thing now, like literally as an alternative to booking.com or something like that. And it actually is the case for a lot of these hotels that they're totally fine to have the bookings come in through Airbnb over and over again and aren't trying to like cut that part out for the commission. So it's not totally exclusive, but there are for these kind of Oracle services where the businesses then depend on the reviews and like the rankings in like the search engine for that. It can be very useful for that, like for companies and people to keep interacting with them and letting them be oracles because they have some moats around that kind of thing. But you would ideally, in some cases for those businesses, you could sort of productively protocolize some things or do some things by exposing it to outside developers and get just some, you know, economies of scale from the natural ability of like startups to come in and try to fill all your cracks, so to speak. So yeah, that's just the context of when we're talking about a centralized Oracle. We're talking about like sort of a Web 2 style business that thinks it has enough like oomph to start, giving its stuff out and trying to let like sort of smaller market cap SaaS companies spread its, you know, religion through, you know, the universe.
I think that's a really good summary of what we're trying to target there.
And I think for that case, as much as I would like it, yeah, it probably does make sense not to focus on the how do I develop such a centralized service on Keynode, as much as I would like to get at that part sooner than later, because I think it is a thing. And I think some of the ergonomics and stuff around stuff like that is, I'm going to really talk myself into like just build like sort of reverse engineering Rama at some point. It's going to happen. I can see it. But also like, you know, integrating with services that are sort of fully deployed and up there. So
yeah.
Now, does that the ZK end game? I don't know. I guess it is, in the sense that if you have this stuff accessible and people want, like apps want to do stuff with ZK for like sort of the assets part of it, but also want to integrate with centralized Oracle type things, I think that becomes pretty interesting then and gives those companies a way to access that. But that's definitely more speculative. There's some ideas we have for applications that could like directly start doing that, but it is a little bit maybe like one step away relative to the initial roll-up stuff. Maybe. I think it is. Maybe not. I guess the context where it wouldn't be would be if we take Holium and they have some centralized components that they want to be, you know, as oracles or sort of commoditized. And we then start, you know, I could see a phase where they quickly want to add on a very programmable roll-up component. And maybe that's a way we start to, you know, get to start testing some of this.
Yeah. We'll,
we should like incept
hopefully
them.
Hopefully get a chance to do that. Yeah.
Well, we've been going for a while. Sorry, go.
Yeah. I was just going to ask if we want to throw it to possible questions and then wrap it up.
Yeah, definitely. For our, anyone have anything that's interesting to them from this?
Yeah. So if you want to ask a question, go ahead and raise your hand. Otherwise, is there anything else that you guys want to hit before we close out? Goldfinger or Doria? All right. In that case,
No?
Okay. So I'll just remind everybody that if you check the link after this space, you'll find that we have links to our documents, and you can also find a link to join us on Discord. So below the link below the space tweet is where those will be. And otherwise, I'll just say thanks to Basile, Doria, and Goldfinger. And we will see you next week, hopefully, for the next office hours.
Yeah, things are moving fast. We'll have a lot more to talk about then, too.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Next week.
Bye. Cheers. Guys.